morning. Welcome to the House Education Finance Committee. And I am excited to see the snow and the sun, but I hope everybody got a safe drive in today and uneventful, hopefully. It's never good when you see an ambulance spun out on an off-ramp, which I saw this morning. Hopefully everybody was okay. So we are going to continue on with the Minnesota Department of Education, talking about all the historic investments we made and how they are implementing them for us. So if folks remember, first we have to do the minutes. Representative Hill, or Representative Purcell, I believe if you peruse the minutes, we found one correction that you know about. Representative Purcell.
Madam Chair, can I get assistance on what the correction needs to be?
Yeah, the correction is.
I looked over the minutes, but I didn't see it.
So, okay, so Dr. McCarry's name was spelled improperly, so we will be correcting that.
Okay, assuming that we fixed that spelling error, I move the minutes from yesterday.
Thank you. Representative Purcell moves the minutes from February 14th, 2024. Any other corrections or thoughts on the minutes? With that, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The minutes for February 14th, 2024 have been passed. Now with that, we are going to move on with the Minnesota Department of Education. Folks will still have their slideshow presentation in their packets. And the first person we have up is we're going to have Commissioner Jett come on up again. Welcome back, Commissioner Jett. We get settled. Still, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, good morning. My name is Willie Jett, and I serve as the Commissioner of Education. Thank you for having us back on this snowy Minnesota morning to continue our update on the implementation of some of the programs that were passed in the 2023 legislative session. Every one of us here we're here to make sure that our schools provide safe and healthy and supportive teaching and learning environments, and we are glad to be part of the implementation of the life-changing work done last session. Yesterday, we shared important information on a range of programs and operations at MDE, all essential for carrying out the work of the 2023 legislation. Okay. You heard about the updates completed and those yet being developed relative to grant administration. You learned about the new Office of Inspector General. MDE is committed to continuous improvement. And these new efforts at the department will only make us better stewards of the state's resources. You also heard about all the trainings MDE's EDI team is doing to help educators throughout the state. And These are critical to supporting safe and healthy and supportive school communities. And we also provided an update on the Special Education Teacher Pipeline Grant Program. We know that the federal law requires qualified teachers to work with students receiving special education services. This grant program will help many of our educators get the licensure they need to stay in the classroom. Today we will move on to several other topics, including the READ Act, mental health, and free school meals. With me today, I have Assistant Commissioners Bobby Burnham, Dr. Makari Trainum, and Darren Cordy. The work we will discuss today is critical to the success of our students now and into the future. We have shared a goal of giving our students access and opportunity to world-class literacy instruction, and we at MDE, along with the educators across the state, have been busy turning that goal into reality. At MDE, we hired our state literacy director, Julie Novak, and we have completed the curriculum review selection. We are also making strides in the area of student mental health, and we established the Student Support Personnel Aid Program, Support Personnel Pipeline Competitive Grant Application, just closed several weeks ago. And we have hired several staff members with expertise in mental health to better support our educators and students. Additionally, we are seeing great results from our free school meals program, with both breakfast and lunch participation jumping by double-digit percentages. And with that, Madam Chair, I turn to Assistant Commissioner Bobby Burnham to discuss the READ Act. Bobby.
Thank you, Commissioner Jacks. Folks can settle here. Assistant Commissioner Burnham, as soon as you can settle, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Bobby Burnham, and I serve as the Assistant Commissioner for the Office of Teaching and Learning at the Minnesota Department of Education. We're happy to be with you this morning to share all the great implementation updates and successes with the READ Act legislation. The goal of the READ Act is to ensure that every child in Minnesota can read at or above grade level, and as well as multilingual learners and students receiving special education services get the support needed to achieve their individualized reading goal. What the READ Act does for our Minnesota students, families, and educators is increase equitable access to effective literacy experiences for all students, ensure school leaders and educators are trained in structured literacy, implements and measures instructional practices through a multi-tiered system aligned to the state academic standards, utilizes literacy data to inform instruction, educator development, resource deployment and policy, and employs intentional family literacy and community engagement strategies. By effectively implementing these core components from kindergarten, even before kindergarten and onwards, Minnesota school leaders and educators will have the supports to effectively teach children the foundational reading skills necessary to achieve grade level reading. This slide is an overview of the core components of the READ Act and provides an update under each of these important areas: assessment, evidence-based curriculum, intervention, professional learning, and literacy coaching. Until the READ Act, the main investment has been in the professional learning category, and that was due to the $3 million allocation for letters training in the 2022 session. The READ Act has given Minnesota the much-needed shot in the arm in these other vital core areas, which the READ Act addresses. Implementation successes to date include meeting our July 1 deadline of selecting and posting the universal screener menu, the August 15th deadline of posting an approved menu of training providers, the September 15th deadline for getting our request for information and process approved for the curriculum selection, and our January deadline of actually posting the approved curriculum list. As the commissioner mentioned, we have a new state literacy director. We also have a READ Act data literacy specialist and a READ Act training and communication specialist. Contracts for the training as well as the development of our regional literacy networks with the Minnesota Service Cooperatives are close to being executed. This slide indicates some successes from our year one. It also indicates what our goals for year one implementation are, as well as implementation milestones and key performance indicators. You can see in the text that is in green are all activities that have been completed or close to being completed in year one, and we're just into February. So it has been a busy last 6 months. Dr. Kim Gibbons is here with us today. Carrie has been a key and vital partner in the implementation of the READ Act and the resource development, and she is here to share updates around the curriculum selection process.
Dr. Gibbons, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Kim Gibbons. I'm currently the director of the Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement, otherwise known as CARI, at the University of Minnesota. So again, thank you. I'd like to talk a little bit with you about the process that we used to develop a state-approved list eligible for reimbursement of curriculum. And I'd like to start out by talking about the rubric that we used as part of to review the curriculum. And this, I think it's important to understand that this rubric has been tested out in schools, both here and also in California, in partnership with MDE. So we began with an initial rubric, which I'll call version one, and I'm also the co-director of the Wisconsin-Minnesota Comprehensive Center. So it's a federally funded grant that provides support to state educational agencies in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And one of the deliverables on the Comprehensive Center grant was to collaborate on forming a curriculum review rubric. We did that, and then we tested it with a number of schools in Minnesota that volunteered to meet with us and go through the rubric. They were mostly districts that were involved in the curriculum review process. We went through that process. We also did some more usability testing. We came up with a second version of the rubric that we tested with some group school districts out in California. We came back, we hired staff that are working on the READ Act and did comprehensive training with our staff on the version two. And based on feedback, we arrived at a third version that really is looking at eight domains within each curriculum. There's a global domain, which isn't an overall rating, but it's looking at usability for teachers. There's some multilingual supports, ELL support indicators built into that. But then we looked at the main areas of what we know is important for effective reading instruction: phonemic awareness, phonics and morphology, fluency, comprehension, vocabulary, writing, and we had a section on cultural responsiveness. So what we did was we looked at the rubric and includes what I'm going to call look fors, and the look fors are evidence-based practices in each of the domains that I just described. We also had something that we called red flags, and red flags are non-evidence-based practices. They're things we don't want to see in the curriculum. So we got to the point where we went through and we scored each curriculum and we looked for look fors, we looked for red flags. I do want to point out that other states are using a variety of methods when they are reviewing curriculum to go on the list. So that's a question that I get really often is, why isn't our list the same as Colorado? Or why isn't our list the same as Ohio? And the answer to that is because states use a variety of ways to evaluate curriculum. Some states rely on Ed Reports exclusively. Ed Reports is a organization that also reviews curriculum, and they primarily focus on alignment of standards. Unfortunately, you can meet expectations on Ed Reports, but that doesn't mean that the curriculum is aligned to the science of reading or to evidence-based practices. Other states take a more superficial review, and they will look at a curriculum, and they'll look to see, oh, do they have anything on phonemic awareness? Is there anything on phonics? They don't go deep to find out what that instruction looks like, and they're not looking for the red flags. And so what I think we found in this curriculum review, and I'll tell you in a minute how many we reviewed, we found that many of the popular curricula used across the United States are operating under two theoretical paradigms. One is a balanced literacy approach, and then they sprinkle in structured literacy. But what happens is you have two paradigms that oppose each other, and it's confusing for kids. So I'm really proud of the work that MBE and Peary did on this. I strongly believe that we're leading the country. I've had several other states reach out and commend the work that we did on this list. But the bottom line is that nothing that we reviewed was 100% aligned with the look fors. And there were lots of curriculum that had decent look fors in some domains, but also lots of red flags. So if I take us to the point now of the curriculum program review types, as Bobby said, we put out the RFI. We had 42 publishers submit at stage one for the submission process. There was a number of programs that were excluded because they actually weren't core curriculum materials. They were intervention programs. So we narrowed it down to 12 comprehensive curriculum were reviewed. And a comprehensive curriculum is a curriculum that's designed to provide instruction across all of those domains that I mentioned. So we had 12 comprehensive curriculum. We had 14 foundational curriculum, and a foundational curriculum is a curriculum that's really focused on those foundational skills, phonemic awareness, phonics, morphology, and fluency. But there is not a comprehension vocabulary component to those. We also had a submission from one knowledge building curriculum, and a knowledge building curriculum is focused on comprehension, vocabulary, writing. So if a knowledge building program is approved, it would have to be paired with a foundational skills program. And if a foundational skills program was selected, it would have to be paired with a knowledge building program. So let's see where I'm at here. So the publishers received the rubric, and they were asked to provide evidence at every grade level for the look fors, and they were also supposed to indicate red flags. I will tell you that none of the publishers said they had any red flags, and not every publisher provided evidence at every grade level for the look fors. But our team went deeper, even though we probably wouldn't have had to, because it was a lot of time. In those grade levels where they did not provide evidence, we looked for them in those grade levels. So we also asked for teacher editions, access to any documents that they referenced in the rubric, program assessments, and then the scope of and sequence for everything that was reviewed. So the big picture then is, I forgot this. I want to tell you that we had 32 reviewers looking at curriculum that were well-trained from Peary, from MBE. We pulled in some former Regional Centers of Excellence centers, and then we had a few outside consultants that were trained in letters or CORE, one of the professional development programs on the list. And for a 7-week period, we tracked hours, and it was 11,226 hours of work, which I think explains why many people are still exhausted. Yeah, it was a lot of work. So the big picture in terms of how, once we did the review, we entered all of the data into a spreadsheet for the look fors, for the red flags, and at the end of the day, a decision was made that we would put things on the list that were either, they had 80% or more of the look fors, the things that we were looking for, or they were above the median of all programs. So what it really ended up with was, it was anything that was 80% or more, but there's a few that were only 75%. They were above the median and they didn't have any red flags.
So, Dr. Gibbons, I have one quick question.
Yes.
From a member, just a clarification question. Representative Fryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think we're all just like hanging on every word you're saying because this is so interesting. But could you just give an example of what a red flag is?
Oh,
I think that would be really appreciated.
Thank represent prior Dr. Gibbons.
Good. I personally did not do the reviews, but I have to just pull up the rubric and I can give you, I don't have them all committed to memory. Here we go. Okay, so I'm going to give you a couple of red flags from phonics. The phonics is one of the big domains for foundational reading. So a red flag would be that instruction incorporates a three cueing system approach to word reading. So instead of teaching kids how to sound out the words, they're encouraged to look at the pictures, to guess, look at the letter. Another one would be if teachers provide guidance to prompt students to use sentence context to decode words. Do you want more?
No, that's okay.
Thank
you. That was my guess.
Okay.
But thank you so much.
Yes, and we can
go ahead, Dr. Gibbons.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. We can certainly provide a copy of the curriculum review rubric as well for you to look at. So again, the things that on the list were 75% or more of the look for is what we want to see. And the lowest percentage of red flags. I would say no red flags, but there was one instance where one thing had a red flag, but it's able to be fixed and corrected. So if you roll the drums and I'll put the list up of the approved curriculum review programs. So there's one comprehensive program that made that cut. That's called EL Education Open Up Resources. And you can see that it met in every domain. The next one is Wit and Wisdom, which is a knowledge building curriculum. And then we have three foundational skills curriculum: magnetic reading, UFLY, which is out of the University of Florida, and the University of Minnesota has a program called the University of Minnesota Functional Phonics and Morphology. I do need to mention that there's been questions about conflict of interest. We worked with the conflict of interest management program at the university to mitigate this in the beginning. Nobody from my staff reviewed that program. They were reviewed by outside agencies, and there's no READ Act dollars or any other state funds that are being used to support that program. Finally, we're now at the curriculum reconsideration and reimbursement stage. All publishers have received their rubrics. Publishers have until February 29th to submit additional evidence. So they have to show us what are the look-fors that we missed, and they have to defend the red flags and provide some type of either we didn't identify it correctly or... That one's going to be a difficult one, but they have to address the red flags. Our team then has 60 days to review the additional information to determine additions to the list. And then once, is this you? Okay, good.
All right. Assistant Commissioner Burnham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reimbursement process is also being developed. We need to wait until the reconsideration process is completed to see if any of those publishers who have submitted for reconsideration get added to the approved list, and then we will put out the process for reimbursement. We are working with our school finance team around designing an equitable, not only financially, but geographically distribution process for those reimbursement funds. So the READ Act, as some of you may know, has three approved trainings: letters, core, and carry-all. And we have the statute states that beginning July 1 of 2024, districts must have access to one of these three trainings. So February 1, the registration process, the first step was posted on the READ Act webpage, and that has asked districts to identify their district literacy lead, the person who will be facilitating and managing the training for the READ Act. And we are asking that phase one teachers are prioritized in this registration process. We also acknowledge that there will be some phase two teachers that it makes just better sense financially to join the phase one, especially in those smaller rural areas. So we are working with those districts as well. You can see on this slide who is considered a phase one teacher and who is considered a phase two teacher. We have received quite a few questions around how we are defining some of these roles in each of phase one and phase two, so we have put out some pretty detailed guidance. We are still working on the instructional support staff piece and acknowledge that their role may or may not be limited in reading instruction. So we're looking at some training options for instructional support staff. As I mentioned, each district has submitted a survey with the contact information. Once MDE receives that contact information, that sets off another email that sends to the district lead to provide the number of teachers, the grade level, and which training they have selected to MDE. So we have that database at MDE, and then we then send that information to the vendor who contacts the district to schedule the training. So the money exchange for the training will be between MDE and the three training vendors. And then the district works with the vendor to actually schedule the training. To support districts in this registration process, our team at MDE offered open office hours all last week and then once a week moving forward. The registration timeline is February 1 through October 1. And we know that districts who choose letters will need more than the 1 year given to them. So we have the ability in the READ Act to grant extensions to those districts who need more time to complete letters. Another exciting opportunity with the READ Act is the establishment of our regional literacy networks. So we are transitioning our regional or our centers of excellence into regional networks and really focusing on our Compass School Improvement Framework and our MTSS framework. So these regional literacy networks are going to be the literacy arm of that work. And so each Minnesota Service Cooperative will have a regional or a literacy network, and each literacy network will have a literacy lead and a team of coaches. The number of coaches is dependent on their region and the number of teachers served. The work of the regional literacy networks will be facilitated and managed by the team at MDE and Cary. The READ Act also establishes a coaching framework. So in partnership with Cary, we will develop an evidence-based literacy lead training program that trains the literacy coaches to support schools in their efforts to implement the items in the READ Act, such as screening, measuring growth, monitoring progress, and implementing the evidence-based instruction and interventions. The coaching framework will be in partnership and integrated with the Minnesota MTSS coaching framework. And then we are working right now to determine the process for certified training facilities. We know that Letters has a training, and we want to build local capacity. What we want to be sure of is that those local facilitators have the training and the certification necessary to qualify them to lead a group of teachers through this training as required. And that, committee members and Madam Chair, is all we have for the READ Act today.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Burnham. We have a few questions at the table. Representative Clarke.
Thank you for the presentation. I like all the layers that are within that are being worked on. Just had a question, kind of a two-part question. You talked about reimbursement in relationship to the three core programs. Is that also connected to the new curriculum? And then also, for those curriculums that are being reconsidered, if you could kind of talk about the difference between what is a curriculum and what you consider instructional materials. Because I know that there is a program that's using instructional materials that's having great success right now, but they're not on the approved list yet.
Who would like to take that? Dr. Gibbons?
When we reviewed the different curricula, we were looking at the teacher guides, and we were looking at the assessments, and the materials are part of the curriculum. But again, we were asking the publishers to provide us with the evidence. So they had to put like examples of materials or page numbers from the teaching guide for evidence. So this is an opportunity in the reconsideration process for those publishers to go back, and if they didn't provide examples of certain materials, this is their opportunity to do that.
Representative Clark. Assistant Commissioner Burnham for the second part of the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, I believe your question was around the training, that if a district purchases a new training, there of course needs to be training on that curriculum, and will that reimburse be part of the reimbursement?
Representative Clark.
Thank you. Yes, as far as like teacher hours, because it's going to take time for those teachers, right, to be trained. So, yes.
Assistant Commissioner Burnham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, currently, the time that teachers are taking one of the three approved READAC trainings, Carry All, CORE, or Letters, districts are all doing it how it best works for them. Some districts are working it into their professional development calendar. Some districts are working to look for and provide subs. Some districts might be offering a stipend. Those currently are not covered in the READ Act allocation to pay teachers to take the training. But that is one of the $1 million questions that we get asked quite often.
Thank you. Just the last comment. The regional literacy and networks make a lot of sense. Thank you.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for your presentation. It's fun to see, you know, the words on the bills actually be fleshed out, and I can tell you're doing a very thorough job, so thank you so much for that. Two questions concerning the funding. That the legislature provided for this. The first one, I'll ask them both because I think they're fairly easy, but the first one is, does the funding for curriculum cover manipulatives that perhaps are outside of the basic program the district purchases? For example, I was in the Wells schools over the interim and observed a number of classrooms implementing, I think they have the UFLY program. It was very good, and you can see they had, you know, they were doing phonemic awareness and phonics and all those things. They had purchased these great magnetic kits for kindergarten, first, and I think second grade for working with the letters and the sound. So I'm wondering if those outside materials are covered in the amount of money we gave for curriculum. Second is, how is that money going? Can you foresee it's going to be enough? Can you already see it's going to run out quickly for this curriculum reimbursement?
Assistant Commissioner Burnham.
Madam Chair, Representative, those are really great questions. So the first question around materials falls under what I believe to be the supporting materials, curriculum and supporting materials. Many curriculums come with that, and those that don't, I believe that falls under those supporting materials.
Blank on what your last question was.
Is there going to be enough money?
So That is a question that comes up often as well, not only for the curriculum materials, but the training as well. We will have a better idea probably in the next 30 days around the number of teachers who have registered, so how far that those funds will go. And additionally, the same kind of awareness of the curriculum funds. Once we know what is going to be on the list come early spring, we will seek information from districts. We'll know who currently is implementing one of those approved curriculums and who plans to implement. So we'll have a better idea early spring on that as well.
Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And if I could ask one more quick follow-up question that just came to my head when you were saying that. Are there some guardrails in the law or in how you're handling this to make sure that these curriculum companies aren't kind of manipulating their costs a bit, knowing that the state's going to be paying for this? That's always a danger when we pay for things, but I think this is good. We should be paying for it. But are there some guardrails to make sure they're not kind of jacking up prices because it's going to be paid for by the state anyway?
Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The part of the reimbursement process is going to build those guardrails in. We're still kind of developing that and developing what exactly is going to fall under a reimbursement and what the curriculum costs are, what the materials costs are. So that is all kind of being drafted right now. But we will absolutely ensure there's some guardrails in there so we know what's being purchased.
Thank you. Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for presenting on this. This is really helpful. And my question is a little bit actually building on what Representative Bennett was talking about. So I guess what I'm kind of trying to understand is I know that something I've heard MD talk about kind of in other legislation related to education is the idea that the state does not provide model curriculum. And so we're kind of now with the READ Act, I understand that we're trying to move to evidence-based practices. But so we're kind of requiring that, you know, any curriculum has to fit this certain model. And so now we've narrowed it down to, you know, only 5 curriculums. And so I'm wondering, is there another subject matter where the state is that prescriptive, or are we kind of entering into new territory? That's my question.
Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a really good question. So I think that the really important point is to make that districts are not required to choose one of these curriculums. They only, if they want reimbursement, they choose from the list. If they're currently using something that is on the list, what we'll do is work with them to make sure they're supplementing it in those areas that didn't meet our requirements. So districts are not required to choose one of these. Secondly, to my knowledge, there are no plans in any of the other academic areas to go down this route.
Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you. That's helpful. And yeah, I think just to echo that, I do think it's like important for this committee then to kind of talk about what are the guardrails, right? I know that there was a piece of legislation, not this session, but last session, around, you know, wanting to give a lot of funding to the letters program. And I know that at that time there was, I think, a good amount of kind of concern about what does it mean for the state to kind of have one main contractor that they're working with. And so I guess I just want to, again, you know, kind of, I think that's something that we should be thinking about. And I would like to maybe, you know, get a sense of, like, how much are we reimbursed, like, how much are we paying for each of these different curriculums, and is it getting to a point where it feels like then the state is almost entering into a contract with some of these curriculum providers, and kind of, like, what does that mean? I think it's something we should be monitoring, I guess.
Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Sensenmura, I want to make sure I'm kind of understanding the point here and maybe provide some clarification. I think we're talking about funding for 2 different buckets. One is for districts to then pay for curriculum providers who are on the list that are eligible for reimbursement. And then the other one is around approved providers of teacher training models. That aren't necessarily considered curriculum, but are considered professional development. So I just wanted to provide that clarification around the contract for the state would be with the professional development providers, and it wouldn't necessarily be a contract with the curriculum providers that are eligible for districts who are using their qualifying curriculum to receive reimbursement.
Great. Representative Moran, any follow-up real quick?
Yeah, thank you. And I think I understand that I just, you know, if it's at the point where we are paying one curriculum $10 million, that's not a formal contract, but I think it still is significant. And I think that there are just concerns that have been raised to me by educators and advocates just around, utilization of private companies for curriculum, not having open educational resources that can be accessed, and what does it mean for state funds to be going.
We're going to try to wrap this up by 11:30, but I have three more people on the list, and we'll go to Representative Baker, and then Pryor, and then Edelson. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple quick questions. And it really centers around teacher training is what I'm thinking about. So am I correct in that the professional development dollars allocated to the local school districts would be used for teacher training? If the money's not there, then it would just come out of the district allocation for professional development.
Assistant Commissioner Berna.
Madam Chair, the READ Act allocates funding for the training itself. So it pays all the instructional materials and for the training of the three vendors. The READ Act currently does not pay for any time at a district that the teacher takes the training. So dependent on how each district designs their professional development calendar, whether it's during the contract day or after, the READ Act funds currently do not compensate.
Representative Pickberg.
Thank you. That answers my question. And then the other piece is the higher education, and this has really been a common question from schools about the relationship between the higher ed institutions that are training teachers. Can you talk about the partnership and the relationship with a higher ed institution in training teachers? Is there any type of requirement that they are using the science of reading in their training?
Assistant Commissioner Burnham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. MDE and Kerry as well are aware of and have been in conversation and actually partner with many institutions of higher ed. Some institutions of higher ed do a much better job than others in ensuring that their teacher candidates come out with training in structured literacy. There, Pelsby right now is completing an audit of institutions of higher ed and where their syllabi lies in providing instruction. Do we need to strengthen that? We do, and we needed to have it be statewide instead of just these pockets of institutions of higher ed who are really taking this to the point where it's needed to ensure that teacher candidates are coming out with that training. Superintendents are starting to look at where their teaching candidates are coming from, which institutions of higher ed they graduated from, and if they are supportive of structured literacy practices. So that is an ongoing conversation and an ongoing area that we'll be working to address.
Representative Pickler?
Thank you for that. And I think just from a very, very practical standpoint, what that means, and you said it well, school administrators are looking at specifically institutions where we're hiring people from, and knowing that if we hire someone from X institution, we are going to have to take on the training of that teacher. And there is widespread disagreement within higher ed. I have relationships within higher ed, and there are some that say we will not teach the science of reading at my institution, and there are some that are just figuring out how to pay it because they want their teacher candidates to be the most equipped when they step into the classroom. And at the end of the day, this whole battle about the science of reading or structured literacy, evidence-based practices, we talked about it last session. We need to make sure that our teachers are equipped, however we do that, in order to teach our kids. And if we don't ensure that higher ed is doing it, we will be having this same exact conversation in a couple years. And all of the money that we invested will not have had the impact that it could have had. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pryor and then Representative Addison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask a question that you look at me and say, I should know the answer to, but I don't know because I just can't remember the legislation in detail. One of the things I've heard from school districts as I've been out around the states is some school districts have already been on this journey, and they started a couple years ago, probably the letters program. So they're not, is there any reimbursement that they would be eligible for, even though they're not at the start of it, but that they're well into it at this point?
Assistant Commissioner Burnham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's not a bad question at all. Currently, the statute states that back to 2021, we are able to reimburse districts who have purchased approved curriculum materials. We are not able to reimburse training prior to the READ Act passing last July
1. I think I'll add in here too, Assistant Commissioner. I think you're able to train their new teachers coming in, and we have a lot of teacher turnover. And I know districts are feeling that way, but I hope they also take some pride in the fact that they were starting down this road already. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to both of you, Commissioner Burnham and Dr. Gibbons. You have worked so hard over the past 6 months, and I always joke that I wake up at 2:30 in the morning and send emails, and I think you both do as well. So READ Act 2.0 is coming, and a lot of the things that you, our committee members brought up actually will be in there. Representative Clardy, teacher stipends are something that we're discussing right now because that's exactly what we've heard from districts all throughout the state of Minnesota is how are we going to pay for teachers' time? And I think we've really heard that, and a lot of the stakeholders have come to the table and said that's a big issue. The Pelsby audit, I think Representative Breitberg is actually a really good thing that you're drawing attention to. And READ Act 2.0, we will be opening the funds for higher ed. We obviously don't want discrimination to happen with teachers as they're going through a hiring process. We have opened up those funds for higher ed in READ Act 2.0, so when you see the draft, that will be in there. The reading audit, I have been working with Pelsby and Yelena and making sure that we really look at the audit will actually go until 2027, and so trying to expedite that as much as possible. What we're asking for in READ Act 2.0, because I will no longer be here, but Representative Clardy and Perez Vega will be taking over READ Act next year, hopefully. But we will be asking for a report to the legislature starting next year that will detail where we are with the reading audit and making sure we're expediting that as much as possible. There's many other issues that will be coming forward in READ Act. One of the things that I want to highlight for the committee is a lot of districts partner with reading programs where when the children are getting pulled out of class, they don't always are not being pulled out of class by somebody that is also trained in the same way the teacher in the classroom might be trained. So we need to make sure that we are looking holistically at this. It's an incredibly complicated piece of legislation, and it's a complicated solve for a complicated problem, but I just want to say thank you. And if you have any issues or if you want to address the READ Act as we move forward, please do talk to me. I'm really open either side of the aisle to feedback because this impacts all of our kids. And just to remember, 50% of kids, again, look at this room. Like, imagine if 50% of us could not read. That's what we're talking about. It's disparities across the board, geographically, racially, urban, rural, all of the things. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Adelson. Thank you for all your work on this. We'll move on to Dr. Makari Trainum. please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Dr. Makari Trainum. I am the Assistant Commissioner for the Office of Equity and Engagement at MDE. Okay. I'd like to begin this presentation today taking a little time to talk about our educators and offer that as we've leaned into and taken big steps about and working to address the mental health of our students, we also have to recognize and address the well-being of staff as well. Educator well-being overlaps and impacts all aspects of the student experience for both staff and students, the school experience for all staff and students. Supporting the well-being of educators and building adult social-emotional competencies supports equity and retention work in our schools. The 2022 Minnesota Principal Survey found the area in which principals would benefit most from additional professional development was in reducing staff burnout. And tasks they identified that they had the least confidence in addressing the least confidence included addressing staff mental health challenges. To further illustrate the importance of educator well-being, I'd like to bring to your attention the RAND survey, which examines the state of educator well-being. This survey specifically looks at job-related stress, burnout, symptoms of depression, coping, and resilience, and they found that well-being is especially poor among teachers of color, mid-career teachers, and female teachers. The mental health of our educators impacts the mental health of our students. With this in mind, consider the data on this slide, which is from our Minnesota Student Survey regarding the mental health of our students across the state. The graph shows our students reporting greater struggles with mental health, such as depression and anxiety, than at any other time in the survey's history. Students of color reported higher rates of self-harm and suicidality relative to their peers, and students who identify as LGBTQ were over three times as likely to report mental health concerns as students who did not identify as LGBTQ. Further, two-thirds of students who identify as transgender, gender fluid, non-binary, or two-spirit report long-term mental health, behavioral, and/or emotional problems. As you can see from the graph, there has been a steady increase in the number of students reporting self-harm and suicidality. These sobering statistics illuminate the tremendous need for a comprehensive school mental health systems framework in the state of Minnesota. As always, we believe it's important to lift up the research that supports the work we're doing. What we know is that there is a tremendous body of research showing the benefits of school mental health. Some of these improvements include social and self-awareness, decision-making capacity, relationship skills, better academic outcomes, increased student engagement, and feelings of connectedness to school. We also see fewer special education referrals and decreased need for restrictive placements and fewer disciplinary actions. The key components of a comprehensive school mental health system are well-trained educators and specialized instructional support personnel, family-school community collaboration and teaming, needs assessment and resource mapping, multi-tiered systems of support, mental health screenings, evidence-based and emerging best practices, data outcomes, system and data-driven decision-making, funding, and sustainability. A comprehensive school mental health system is a model for the delivery of mental health supports and services that is multi-tiered in its supports to caring for the needs of all students. It provides a full array of supports and services that promote positive school climate, social and emotional learning, and mental health and well-being, while reducing the prevalence and severity of mental illness. A fundamental component of this model is providing culturally responsive and equitable mental health care across a multi-tiered system of support. The Minnesota Comprehensive School Mental Health Systems Framework is strategically aligned with the One Minnesota Plan, the work of the Children's Cabinet, the Due North Education Plan, and the mission, vision, and beliefs of the Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Center at MDE. By housing the mental health framework in the EDI Center and centering equity in our mental health work, We created the first of its kind in the nation for our Department of Education, and for that we should be proud. We've aligned and created a commitment to being culturally responsive in both our framework and subsequent services, trainings, and resources. Minnesota has thus become a proud leader with our comprehensive mental health systems framework. As we look at the 2023 legislative session, several health-related provisions were passed. This included the student support personnel aid to schools, as well as the workforce pipeline grant funding. The student support personnel workforce pipeline, it's a lot of words there, grant to institutions of higher education will begin in April and will focus on increasing school psychologists, school nurses, school counselors, and school social workers. This proposal focuses on professional respecialization, recruitment, and retention. The student support personnel position, which closed on February 9th, will support the grant and provide professional development, guidance, and technical assistance. There is also dedicated funding to the EDI Center. Before the legislative session, 70% of the positions in the EDI Center were grant funded. With the dedicated funding, now only 26 positions of the center's positions remain grant funded. This consistent and comprehensive support allows the EDI Center to continue to support staff, students, and families across the state. The state mental health lead position and the school nurse consultant positions have also been filled. These positions will be described further in the next slide. Suicide prevention information on the student ID cards and in planners for students in grades 6 through 12 is also taking place as a result of the partnership between MDE and MDH. Lastly, the social emotional learning framework has been developed and is showcased on our MDE webpage. Okay. The EDI Center has created a comprehensive mental school health framework to support the needs of learners, students, educators, families, and community. The framework is led by the mental health lead and includes six positions that are interconnected and are each responsible for a component of the mental health system we are building. Minnesota has taken a systematic approach. This is not a one and done, but a program founded on the principles of equity and comprehensive school mental health systems. All of the positions will report their outcomes to the mental health lead in order to build and align state resources and partners in a comprehensive systems framework. The mental health lead will lead the development of agency comprehensive school mental health systems programs for students, learners, educators, leadership, and aligned state resources and partners. The student support personnel position will coordinate the work of the student support personnel workforce pipeline grant and focus on the recruitment and retention of BIPOC students in the workforce pipeline. This position will provide ongoing professional development and support to staff working in roles as school nurses, school social workers, school counselors, and school psychologists. This position prioritizes the impact of positive well-being of those working in the positions to support students' mental health. Okay. The statewide school nurse consultant will focus on the role of school nurses in the comprehensive school mental health systems framework, because over 30% of school nurse services are actually mental health related. The crisis management team will carry out the Safe and Supportive Schools Minnesota Act by addressing bullying, harassment, and intimidation, as well as provide guidance and professional development related to prevention, intervention, and postvention of mental health related crises. The health and youth development position will focus on health equity and culturally responsive health and wellness by incorporating comprehensive mental school health systems framework into the whole school, whole community, and whole child model. Lastly, there are two Project Aware grants focusing on intensive efforts within six districts focusing on advancing their comprehensive school mental health systems. Student support personnel, which includes school social workers, school psychologists, school counselors, and school nurses, are the vital link between the home, school, and community, and provide services and student supports academically, socially, emotionally, behaviorally, and provides mental health success. They work with school administrators, teachers, students, and families, and provide leadership in forming school policies, mental health interventions, support services, academic success plans, and crisis management. Schools are often the first line of defense in addressing the social, emotional, and behavioral health needs of students. Intervening early is critical, given that early identification and treatment improves outcomes. Student support personnel fill a critical role in both identifying struggling students and connecting them with treatment and other services they need. However, most schools across the state lack student support personnel to provide the early intervention. Workforce shortages prevent schools from providing crucial mental health services to students in need. The pipeline, defined as the supply of student support personnel in the field, remains a concern. The goals of this grant are to increase the size of student support personnel pipeline and to increase the rate of graduates who become licensed. Further, this grant seeks to support previously licensed professionals seeking school nurse consultant. Seeking school nurse consultants will focus on the role of school nurses in the comprehensive school mental health systems framework because over 30, oh, I read the wrong thing. My apologies. Forgive me. I thought that didn't sound right. So I'm going to try that again. Further, this grant seeks to support previously licensed professionals seeking re-specialization to work in the school setting. The most racially, ethnically diverse population in the nation is children in schools. Student support personnel are the service providers of this diverse group of students. Thus, developing a workforce that is reflective of this diversity is essential to effective services and supports. Furthermore, in addition to increasing the workforce, the program is intentionally designed to increase the number of student support personnel providers who identify as people of color, Black, and or indigenous. As we have dedicated positions that came directly out of legislation, the mental health lead position is currently staffed. This position will serve as a source of information and support for schools. They will also provide professional development, technical assistance, guidance, and resources to advance comprehensive school mental health programs. The school nurse consultant position is filled with the newly hired individual beginning on February 28th. This position will provide leadership and support for the design, implementation, and evaluation of state and local policies and programs that address the health needs of children, youth, and adolescents in school settings and early childhood education programs across the state so that it can promote healthy development and safety, which enhances the educational outcomes. This last slide, second to last slide, is a more streamlined depiction of the six positions that I described earlier that are assigned to operationalize the comprehensive school mental health framework. It will be led by the mental health lead and includes six positions that are interconnected and are responsible for a component of the mental health system we are building. Finally, MDE is partnering with MDH to provide guidance to schools related to suicide prevention, information on students' ID cards, and in student planners for all students in grades 6 through 12. We are currently engaging with students to inform this guidance and to ensure the language used on the ID cards resonates with our young people. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Trainum. I know we started a little late today, so we have permission to go about 10 minutes over, but I do want to get through the rest of the agenda, but we do have time for a few quick questions for Dr. Trainum. Anybody? Representative
Perez-Vega. Thank you, Chair. Yes, and I, in regards to the student support personnel, where the request for proposals was released in December 14th, how many RFPs were received?
Dr. Trainum.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. And off the top of my head, I do not know, but I can get that information for you.
Thank you. And if you could.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you. If we could also, if I could receive also the overall that are in the metro area versus greater Minnesota.
Will
do. Dr. Trainum, thank you.
Yes, we will provide that for you.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you. Any other questions? With that, we will move on to our final section on universal meals. switch up folks, and as soon as you get down, get settled, Assistant Commissioner Cordy, go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Darren Cordy. I'm an Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education for the Minister, the Office of Student Support Services, which includes our Nutrition Program Services Division. And I am here to talk about implementation of the Minnesota Free School Meals Program. So you will remember that the Free School Meals Program is a state-funded program that provides reimbursement for meals to students who do not qualify for free or reduced price meals, so that all students in the state receive a breakfast and lunch that meets federal meal patterns at no cost. Schools participating in the Free School Meals Program are required to participate in the National School Lunch Program as well as the School Breakfast Program and adhere to the regulations of those programs, which include serving meals that meet the federal nutrition program requirements. You'll also remember that the way this works is that schools serve meals to students and then they submit claims to MDE for reimbursement. Claims are in the forms of meals and not expenses. We count meals served and not students served. Meal claim reimbursements are meant to cover the entire cost of serving a meal as well, so it's not just covering the costs of the food, but it's also covering staffing costs, equipment, facilities, utilities, etc. Meal claims are required to be submitted to MDE within 60 days of the end of the claim month. So this means that we currently only have complete claim data up through the end of November 2023, and months earlier than that, we're currently collecting claim data for December, January, and February. Statewide meal claims won't be finalized for the entire school year until September 2024. We spent some time this summer working with districts to verify all of their claims that are submitted, to clean up some of the data, and then we close out at that point. So I'm sure folks will be wanting to get that information right at the end of the school year. We can certainly provide preliminary data, but finalized data won't be available until September 2024. So the big news is comparing September 2022 to September of 2023, we saw large increases in participation in both breakfast and lunch. At breakfast, we saw increases of 31% in terms of the number of meals served, and then lunch participation, an 11% increase in the number of meals served. And you can see the actual raw number breakdowns there, broken down by free, reduced, and paid. One of the things that we found very interesting in this data was that not only did the program increase the number of meals that were served to students who are not eligible for free and reduced price meals, but we also saw significant increases in the number of free meals that were served to students who qualify for free meals under the federal program, in the ballpark of about 500,000 additional breakfasts and 600,000 additional lunches. Again, these are meals that were not served and paid for under the Minnesota Free School Meals Program. These were served under the existing National School Lunch and Breakfast Programs and therefore fully reimbursed using federal dollars and not state dollars. We attribute some of this increase to the number of schools participating in the federal community eligibility provision, which I'll talk about in the next slide. But we also attribute some of it due to the extensive public outreach campaign that was conducted by MDE, our other partner agencies such as the Department of Human Services, the Governor's Office, and then of course our anti-hunger advocacy partners such as Hunger Solutions. So moving on to the community eligibility provision, also known as CEP, you may remember that the legislation last year required schools that were eligible for the community eligibility provision to participate in that provision in order to participate in the Minnesota Free School Meals Program. The way that CEP works is that if a school has a certain number of students or percentage of students, I should say, who are eligible through direct certification for free or reduced meals, they can apply to MDE to have all of their students receive meals at no cost regardless of their household income or the overall household income of the school. And also a reminder that those meals are all served under the federal program, so those meals that are served are not coming out of the state program. Those are coming out of the federal program and reimbursed with federal dollars and not state dollars. The 2023 legislation again required all schools who are eligible to participate in CEP to also participate. Those who wanted to participate in the free school meals program had to participate in CEP, and so because of this, we saw participation increase dramatically. You can see from the slide that we increased from about 160 sites in the prior year to 140 sites this year. The way that this works is that, and then you'll see sponsors as well. Sponsors are the LEA that oversees the entire district or charter school, and then the site itself is the place where the meals are served. So you can see we had a huge increase in the number of districts participating as in charter schools participating, as well as the number of sites participating. And then lastly, I wanted to talk a little bit about free and reduced forms in the application for educational benefits. There was some interest from the legislature in that last year. So just as a reminder, there's two ways that a student can qualify for free or reduced meals, and that's through direct certification or through completing the application for educational benefits. Direct certification is a process by which we take data from the Department of Human Services and look at participation in other public benefit programs such as SNAP, TANF, MFIP, and Medicaid, and determine if a student can automatically qualify for free or reduced meals without having to go through the process of a family filling out the application for educational benefits. We've really tried to beef up that program to reduce the burden on families in the last few years, particularly with the addition of Medicaid direct certification. However, there are still a number of students who only qualify for free or reduced meals through the form. Another thing that we wanted to point out is that the federal government, as a term of our participation in the National School Lunch Program and Breakfast Program, does require us to request those forms from families and get them to complete those forms. The information on those forms is also essential to helping us identify which schools are eligible for the community eligibility provision. It also helps determine eligibility for which child and adult care food or which child care programs and after school programs qualify for the adult child and adult care food programs and summer food programs. And then there's also a number of other state programs in which we use that data to determine eligibility, such as early learning scholarships, title programs, et cetera. And we're working on a report for you that will be published that includes all that information as well. So I believe that's all the information I have for you today. Happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I'll be brief. Maybe you can go back a few slides. I didn't quite understand. I guess I'm looking for how many, and I know you only have September data. It would be great to actually see the other months that you have the data for. But how many new or more lunches in each category? You know, it says free, reduced, paid. So is that paid people that normally would have paid for them and aren't? Or what are these? This doesn't make.
Yep.
I'm sorry. Assistant Commissioner Cordy.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. Yeah. So the increase that you'll see in the free and reduced areas, well, I'll start with free. Free would be, those increases would be 100% attributable to the federal program. So those are children who were newly eligible or otherwise eligible that weren't participating in the program before that are now receiving free meals under the federal program, so not part of Minnesota Free School Meals, the state program. Under the reduced program, the state has always provided the difference between the federal reduced share and the full cost, so that's really nothing new either. The difference is that under the paid category, when you look at September of 2022, who the payer was. So in September 2022, it was families that were paying for the cost of those meals, or I should say the non-federal reimbursement cost of those meals. And then in September, those meal counts, for lunch, for example, the 5,800,000, those are being paid for with the new state program, the free school meals program. So it's really a shift from families paying to the state paying.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I'd like to, see a chart, just maybe reformat this.
Of course.
And then, September, October, November, but I know that there, we've talked about there's a deficit in the program, it's being used more, which is probably a good thing, right? That the, it's being used more, but that isn't real clear as to why. And we, that's the question that we need to answer. Why and where did it, you know, where did it go?
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Cordy. Just get the information to all of us. That'd be great. Any further questions before? Oh, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because and this was on that same page, and especially what you were addressing before. So I think what I heard you say though is there's all these kids that qualified because they're from these low-income families, and they're starting to eat both breakfast and lunch now more. And could you give us those numbers again for both breakfast and lunch? So again, we're thinking of these families that are from the low income and the kids are coming to school and how it's worked out by making universal school meals. More of these kids are actually getting nutrition in school than they did before.
Assistant Commissioner Cordy.
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, yes. Yeah, so this table shows the meals served and not necessarily the number of students served. We will have student enrollment data that is, I believe, being published publicly here in the next couple of weeks. But looking at this data, again, we saw about 500 additional breakfasts year over year that were served to students in that free category and about 600,000 lunches. And again, that's just in a single month. So extrapolate that out over 9 months, and it's a pretty significant increase in the families, you know, who are eligible for that federal program that for one reason or another weren't participating last year. So we're very excited about that.
That was really good.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Spencer Morrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, are there any public schools in Minnesota that have not opted out of the program, and if so, why did they?
Assistant Commissioner Cordy.
Madam Chair, Representative Sensenmira, I do believe that we have a couple of high schools, public high schools, that do not participate in the program, and my understanding is some of that goes back to concerns about, well, it's twofold. Some of it has to go to concerns about the size of the meals and whether or not the caloric requirements in those meals meet the nutritional requirements of students in high school. And then some also it's tied to the a la carte sales that they have. So if a district participates in the school lunch or school breakfast program, they have to adhere to certain requirements when it comes to their a la carte sales, which can be a significant generator, a revenue generator for districts. If they participate in that program, then that means that they're unable to sell maybe some of those a la carte items that are high revenue generators for them. And so that can also be a reason why they choose not to participate. But we can get you the names of the actual schools. In terms of public charter schools, we do have a number that don't participate just because the facilities that they lease don't have the capacity to, you know, have meal service in there. We're working on them to either work get through vended meal contracts with vendors to bring in meals, maybe if they don't have a kitchen on site. But there are still a number of public charter schools that don't participate in the program because of capacity issues.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Spencer Mara. Any follow-up? Okay. We've got two left, and then we're going to finish up for the day. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Really quick question. You know, but we're hearing we're surpassing, more students are taking advantage of this, but could you please tell us just, I mean, what was the estimate of what percentage of children were going to use this program in the first place? I don't know that I've ever heard that.
Assistant Commissioner Cordy.
Sure, Madam Chair and Representative. I'm sorry I don't have the fiscal note in front of me in terms of the cost estimates. We can certainly get that to you. But yes, yeah, so the actual families taking advantage of the program, the cost of the program is, I will say, significantly higher than what our estimation was for it. There is a number of reasons why we think that's the case, one of which the state funding, the state per meal reimbursement funding is tied to the federal reimbursement rate, which the federal government published their federal rates over the summer, which were significantly higher than what we anticipated they would be. So part of it is that tie back to the federal reimbursement rate. And then part of it, too, is, again, I think also kind of this broad public outreach campaign that happened with families and families being aware of this program and wanting to participate and take advantage of it. Maybe we weren't anticipating that. Again, you know, fiscal noting is not a precise science. It's trying to predict human behavior, which can sometimes be a challenge. So our staff did the best they could, and we're happy that more students are taking advantage of the program than us.
Thank you. Representative Altadena-Fella.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, thanks. I just, you know, I think it's a little bit disingenuous that this was such a politically motivated thing that we saw this being a huge, huge campaign. And of course, when we're offering free lunches, of course the public is going to take advantage of that. And so to come in with a low number and estimate, and then to use this as some sort of, like, you know, strategy that now we're feeding more children and how great this is. I mean, that this never should have been a surprise. And I think it's just a little bit disingenuous that we came in with such a low number.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I had some questions about the implementation funding that we provided. But first, I'd like to correct the record. I was the chief author of House File 5, and the motivation and intent of House File 5 was to feed children. If you think that's a political statement, that's on you. But I have some questions for you, Assistant Commissioner. And can you describe the implementation money and time that we appropriated? So the bill did provide money for MDE to do a summer school pilot and to do some implementation work. Can you describe how that money was used, and then what lessons you learned from that, and how that determined the implementation for the start of the fall?
Assistant Commissioner Cordy.
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative, there was some funding that was for MDE, that's correct, to get this program up and running. So we have fully staffed those positions in terms of getting this program up and running, which I think has been really beneficial, particularly for some of those schools that didn't participate before, our public charter schools. And then also a good reminder is that non-public schools can participate in this program. We had a very large influx of interest in that as well. So having staff that were available full time to help schools navigate those programs to come in was essential to that program. You know, in terms of findings from the summer program, I don't have that in front of me right now, but we're happy to type something up for the committee and share that with you as well in the interest of time.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Representative Paris Vega, we have some time. Last word.
Wonderful. Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the question that my colleague, Representative Spencer Murr, asked, you had responded that there was a couple public high schools and a couple public charter high schools. Was it charter schools or high schools?
Madam Chair and Representative, so I'm aware of, I believe, two public high schools, and then I'm not sure of the number of public charter schools that aren't participating, but we can get that.
And
Representative Paris Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do you know as far as where those school districts are? Are they in the cities or are they outside of the metropolitan area?
Assistant Commissioner Cordy.
Sure, Madam Chair and Representative. I think I know where they are, but I want to verify that, and we'll get that back to you. I don't want to speak on the record inaccurately. I do believe they're in the metro area, but I'll get the names of those schools to the committee after.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Representative Paris Vega.
Thank you. No further questions.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you guys for keeping your comments and questions brief that we got through the agenda. We'll be meeting on Tuesday, February 20th at 10:30 a.m. back in our lovely basement hearing room. And we have an exciting agenda actually set up. We have districts coming in and talking about what is working and doing well with the new money we sent them. So with that, members, drive safe home, and we are adjourned.